Welcome to Interviews for Resistance. We are now into the second year of the Trump administration, and the last year has been filled with ups and downs, important victories, successful holding campaigns, and painful defeats. We've learned a lot, but there's always more to learn and more to be done. In this now weekly series, we talk with organizers, agitators, and educators, not only about how to resist, but how to build a better world. I am Sarah Jaffe, your host.
I'm Hunter Blair. I'm the budget analyst at the Economic Policy.
We're talking on Monday. The Trump infrastructure plan, if we can call it that, has been released. And you've been looking at this, the potential, you know, things that were going to be in this for a while. But tell us about sort of what the overall structure of this thing is, what's in it, and what should we be afraid of?
So I think the structure of the plan is what we expected to see. It's only $200 billion in federal funding as opposed to the headline claims of either $1.5 trillion or $1 trillion that the administration have been claiming. Of that, $100 billion goes to this sort of grant program that kicks the funding decisions to states and localities. They are required to come up with 80% of the funding, and the federal government only provides 20%. There's $50 billion for rural projects. I can't remember the rest of the numbers off the top of my head, but all of it sort of comes back to this, what appears to be their belief that state and local governments need to spend even more on funding our infrastructure, and then there are quite a lot of boilerplate claims about leveraging the private sector.
Mm-hmm. And so let's talk about the state funding question right now, because there's a couple of big problems with taking it all to the state, so I'll just let you talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, sure. So state and local governments already account for the vast majority of our public infrastructure spending. CBO had a report where 77% of public infrastructure spending on transportation and water infrastructure comes from state and local governments.
Yeah.
And so it strikes me that if we think that this type of system has led to an underinvestment in infrastructure,
Right. Taking
still further of the onus onto the states seems wrong.
Right. And then, of course, there's the problem of, unlike the federal government, states can't really run a deficit.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So as far as funding is concerned, if the federal government is unwilling to fund it, and sends the decisions to the states, states are going to have to raise taxes or put tolls or user fees on whichever piece of infrastructure because, like you say, they can't run the sorts of deficits that the federal government has.
There's several questions about what this is going to look like in practice. So what kinds of infrastructure are we talking about here? That he's made some promises all over the place, but like, when it comes down to it, what kinds of things would be suggesting be built?
So as far as their claims about leveraging the private sector, what we're talking about there are mostly very large, like mega projects, things that you would see in big urban areas. Outside of that, I think that's the main takeaway for most of the funding. There's the small rural account, but $50 billion over 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so, you know, obviously we have crumbling infrastructure on many levels. One of the big ones that I think is on a lot of people's minds still are things like clean water. I live in a small city in New York that has water problems. Flint still doesn't have clean water. Is there anything at all in plan, such as it is, that would take into account things like that?
Unless a state or local government decided that that was where to put a particular part of the funding, no. And even then, if the, we've already seen how state and local governments have responded to the types of funding constraints that they're under. And so the idea that we're going to get some sort of noticeable increase in infrastructure, with a plan like this, and particularly noticeable increases in places that were having trouble getting states and local governments to fund fully, seems wrong.
And so one of the big reasons that, that people wanted to talk about a big, massive infrastructure project is, of course, like talking about job creation, and particularly the kinds of jobs that have been, you know, that people have been losing, the sort of good-paying construction jobs and that kind of thing. And so what under a plan like this that is, you know, sort of contingent on states eking out some money and or private companies doing things, what does the picture around job creation look like here?
So as far as states and local governments, again, it kind of comes back to the, since this isn't a real infrastructure plan and it's just
right.
kicking all of the decisions to states and local governments, we've seen how they've responded to those decisions. We've seen the underinvestment. So getting more jobs from this is not likely to happen. As far as the public-private partnership type things go, what we're looking at is historically, P3s have avoided Davis-Bacon, and so prevailing wage laws. And so it is very probable that if a lot of, let's say there was a significant increase in infrastructure, if a lot of that came from public-private partnerships, it would not be surprising if these were much worse jobs than they should have been.
Yeah, so let's go a little bit deeper about this public-private partnership thing. It's kind of a buzz term that gets thrown around a lot by politicians of both parties, frankly. Talk a little bit about the history of what these look like in practice, where we've seen them operate, and what the pitfalls have been.
So, you're right, we hear a lot from, we hear about it a lot from a lot of politicians about, boilerplate claims. We're gonna leverage the private sector to find, this many dollars. And at the end of the day, private entities don't bring any more funding to the table. Either the federal government is going to fund it, or you're going to be looking at taxes or tolls or user fees. Private companies do not build our infrastructure for free, and they don't manage or maintain or anything of the sort for free, and they expect to earn a return. And so they'll earn that return through partnerships that allow them to collect tolls or pay them through, say, state and local taxes. And so leveraging the private sector, it gets thrown around a lot, but it certainly doesn't bring any new money to the table. It just brings a different type of financing to the table. And it brings that financing at a time when interest rates are still incredibly low. And so it seems like also the wrong time to be really talking about it. And along with that, public-private partnerships bring their own sorts of problems that you have to deal with. Typically the public sector has provided infrastructure in the U.S. because a lot of infrastructure has natural monopoly characteristics, high fixed costs and low marginal costs that would allow them to keep out competitors. And this means they would have the incentives to hike prices or deteriorate the service quality, which means even if a private sector entity is providing the infrastructure or managing the infrastructure, you still need a strong role for the public sector in regulating it to ensure efficient pricing or good service quality. And again, you're not really getting around needing a strong public role by introducing public-private.
I'm just picturing a giant bridge over the Hudson River that says Trump on it in gold. I'm just like, what are you going to do? Like, sell naming rights to infrastructure? That makes no sense to me. But, you know, I guess that's the slippage here, right? As you say, like, public-private partnership, and what that actually means is we give public goods to private ownership. And then it gets a name. So talk about a little bit about what an actual infrastructure plan that fixed problems that we know we have, like crumbling bridges and water that poisons children, and what ideally that would look like to put people to work and fix problems and maybe, you know, keep us all from dying in a climate change catastrophe.
Yeah, so I think ideally we've seen how much the state and local governments are taking on, and we've seen where that's gotten us as far as underinvestment in infrastructure across the board. And I think that an ideal infrastructure project would be on that size, $1 trillion, $1.5 trillion, $2 trillion, but it would be real federal dollars put on the table to to make the sorts of investments we need. And beyond that, I think public investment is also, it's larger than just infrastructure. We should be investing in early childhood education.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about the kinds of things and the kinds of jobs that are considered infrastructure investments and infrastructure jobs. So we don't think about our public schools as infrastructure in the same way that we think about a bridge.
Yeah, right, but it's absolutely a part of the types of public investments that our country needs, and so it should be part of a broad public investment plan.
So last question. The plan is now out. People have been talking about it, thinking about it, organizing around the issues of infrastructure for a while. What can people do to pressure for real investment, not, you know, giveaways to private companies and dumping the responsibility on the state?
I mean, I think you do what you typically do, right? Call your congressman or senator and talk to them, you know, tell them about the type of infrastructure plan that you'd actually like to see. Real infrastructure investment from the federal government, not just kicking it to states and localities to figure out where to get funding from.
Great. And how can people find out more about this and keep up with your work?
You can find out more at epi.org.
Interviews for Resistance is a project of Sarah Jaffe with assistance from Laura Fayebois and support from the Nation Institute. You can find more information at necessarytrouble.org. Thanks for listening.